From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. A Fiji economics professor says the imposition of retrospective laws on foreign landowners sends a signal that Fiji is not a safe place to invest. But a real estate agent says Fiji is open for business and the changes will help weed out offshore speculators who did little to assist development. Joe O'Brien reports.
British-born New Zealander Arlette Rossi bought an acre of land in Fiji 14 years ago with her husband. She says they planned to build a retirement home when they could afford it and can't meet a requirement introduced in 2014 for foreign landowners to build a $120,000 house within 2 years. She says the retrospective nature of the Land Sales Act amendments is scary.
If I knew now what was going on in Fiji, I would definitely warn people not to invest there. You mean if you had the money and you could build it in 2 years, yep, not a problem. But then what other laws are you going to bring in, you know, down the track? Is you going to make something else to make money out of foreign investors? I don't know. You just can't trust them.
The amendments are due to start biting soon for some foreign landowners, with the prospect of hefty fines or imprisonment for those who fail to comply. James Cook University adjunct professor Waranasi agrees the law is unfair and is sending all the wrong signals to foreign investors.
If you start applying restrictions on people who are not citizens, then you are basically giving a signal to people out there, okay, this is not a place where you can go and invest money safely.
Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister Ayaz Sayed Kayum has stated the law was enacted because of concerns non-residents were buying freehold land and leaving it undeveloped for decades. But that argument is refuted by Professor Nasi.
In Fiji, there's large amounts of land which are lying around idle. A lot of it is native lease and so on, but there's also freehold land. There's no shortage of land. So having this legislation, you know, in place is not necessarily going to see any greater investment. If anything, it's going to discourage investment, you know, even in other areas.
But a real estate agent who specialises in the Fiji market, Rick Commode, maintains the law was brought in to crack down on offshore speculators who did nothing with sections and pushed prices beyond the reach of locals. The Auckland-based Fiji-born citizen says the changes have created some uncertainty and will have a downward effect on prices, but he believes the overall outlook will be brighter for Fiji.
Tourism is booming in Fiji. The new hotels are being built in Nandi by the Chinese, etc. The long-term goal is to see more integrated resort and residential developments, and with the actual hope that people who do come and buy there will actually build on them. That's far more beneficial to the Fiji people, to see actual buildings built and people residing on those properties, employing locals, etc.
Rick Commode says the real issue may be the law's two-year time frame for building a house when the cyclone rebuild has placed an incredibly high demand on builders and materials. He says at a recent symposium in Auckland, the Fiji government indicated it is keen on investment and there is a process for landowners to apply for an extension if required.
The message is quite clear that they're open for business. They want to see more development in Fiji. And, I'm of the opinion that they're happy to sit down and talk about these things if there are real genuine reasons that people can't achieve what they need to achieve within those timeframes.
Rick Commode says the law changes are the start of a process to better control the long-term development of Fiji, and there may be the odd hiccup along the way. This is Joe O'Brien.
A psychiatrist in Tonga is supporting police charging people who've attempted suicide. Tonga police say the number of charges laid for attempted suicide in the country is rising, and there is a need for more mental health support in the country. Under the Criminal Offences Act, convictions for attempted suicide can be punishable to up to 3 years imprisonment. Dr. Mapa Puloka, who heads the psychiatric unit at the Viola Hospital, spoke to Indira Stewart.
There is a growing problem of mental health issue in this country. Big problem. And this also, suicide is part of it, because our rate of suicide, I'm talking about complete suicide, used to be something about 0.3, the 100,000 of the population. But now, it is around 7 to 8, the 100,000 of the population. I understand there's still a controversial issue, regarding attempt suicide in this country because it is illegal. But we cooperate very well with the magistrate or the Supreme Court regarding someone who has attempt suicide. They are very lenient and they always make sure that the punishment, I mean punishment, is for treatment, not the actual charge them. Of course, the police do that. But once they become the magistrate, they refer them to us, mental health. That's how we do it.
What do you think about the act?
There are people who try to decriminalize it. I mean, to make sure that attempt suicide is not a crime. But I'm not really supported. The main reason there is because I want the act to still remain as it is, to deter people not to do that. Once someone is in charge with attempt suicide, we usually intervene and we ask that court to send the patient to us, the psychiatric unit, for examination. And then usually what we do, the magistrate would allow us to continue on with the counseling and the treatment. Once you decriminalize it, people won't come back for counseling and treatment. But still, if you still remain as a crime, you have to force people to come to us for counseling and also treatment.
Is there perhaps a more effective way of providing mental health support in the community for those who are suicidal before they attempt to commit suicide and get charged and then get put in a position where they must get the counselling?
Yes, that's why we do have this organisation. It is known now as Suicide Prevention Tonga. But still, they need more support. They need more funds. Suicide doesn't have any special budget from the government. And since the rate of suicide in Tonga is still lower than the world average, and I'm saying the world average of suicide is 12.5 or 13 persons per 100,000 of any population, but Tonga is around 8. Since we are lower than that, it is really not a priority regarding budget.
Do you think that enforcing the law, like police making more and more charges and arrests for attempted suicide, do you think it so far that's been effective in terms of acting as a deterrent?
There's no research on that too, but I do know. I do know in a way it has that effect. But that's just my assumption. But if suicide is becoming, to me, if the awareness increases, there may be a time in the future we can decriminalize suicide again.
More than 140 candidates have registered to run for 45 seats in next year's constitutional convention in the Marshall Islands. Those who win seats in a February election will decide whether to adopt a series of amendments, the most talked about, which is to change from a parliamentary to a presidential system of government. Joe O'Brien spoke to the Radio New Zealand international correspondent Jeff Johnson about the candidates standing to be part of the Republic's first constitutional review in more than 20 years.
A lot of the sitting members of Parliament, there are 33 total, many of them are candidates for election to the CONCON, and then they're just a separate set of seats that are reserved out of this 45, 12 seats are reserved for traditional leaders, chiefs, so those will be part of the election as well as the members of the public who have registered.
So how significant will the choice of candidates be to the outcome of the convention?
The way the Constitutional Convention setup works in Marshall Islands is that the convention cannot come up with its own amendments. The amendments have to have been adopted previously by the Parliament and then forwarded to the Constitutional Convention for review and action. So there are a number of amendments that have been adopted by the Parliament over the past year or so in anticipation of a CONCON coming up. I would say the most discussed amendment proposed is the direct election of the president, which would change the style of government in the Marshall Islands if it were ultimately approved both in the CONCON and by public vote.
And why has that amendment been put forward? Is there a feeling that the parliamentary style of government isn't working?
The feeling that has come out from particularly from people in the public, I think has centered on the number of motions of no confidence that have surfaced in recent years and the instability that this causes. And secondly, a sense that the president, because they are dependent on maintaining a majority within the parliament, lacks power to enforce accountability in their cabinet and among their party, and that direct election of the president would give the president more of a mandate.
And can we say yet if that's likely to be approved, this measure to bring in a presidential style system?
It's very hard to say what will actually come out of the upcoming constitutional convention, but the challenge is that there have been two previous constitutional conventions in the 37 years of constitutional government here, and none of the amendments that were proposed in previous CONCONs were adopted or were approved by voters.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. An Australian economist says that Papua New Guinea's central bank is risking serious inflation by effectively printing money. The Australian National University's Paul Flanagan, who used to work with the PNG Treasury, says the Bank of PNG is buying up surplus government securities that could not find a buyer on the open market. Explain the impacts of such a move to Don Wiseman.
It's a very worrying trend. The bank seems to be essentially backstopping in saying that whatever government bonds and that can't be sold to the private market, they're going to buy to fund the deficit. And what that does, it essentially starts overheating the economy. You know, like every single government in the world would love it if they never had to worry about raising taxation or actually taking out a loan that they needed to repay to the private sector. They could just print money. But history indicates that overheats the economy, leads to higher inflation, and sometimes leads to hyperinflation.
I suppose one of the effects of a lot of inflation is going to be increased tax take. That would be something coming from it, wouldn't it?
There is an effect, I guess, in terms of nominal values, that yes, there would be an increased tax take. But with hyperinflation, you also end up with problems in affecting your overall growth in the economy. Essentially, when you're at a stage where inflation is going up very, very strongly, business confidence starts to drop. Generally, the ability to borrow any money starts to drop. Borrowing becomes much more problematic in terms of banks lending money to even the private sector, because values keep dropping so much in real terms. So it undermines confidence in the economy, and that is a real problem for improving well-being.
I guess the Bank of PNG found itself in a difficult situation here because, as you say, these bonds weren't being taken up internationally. It had to do something. It had no other choice, did it?
Well, these are certainly difficult choices for government. What was needed to be done was to try and get the budget deficit under control. So in the first place, the deficit should never have been as large as the huge risk they took back in 2013 to try on the assumption of large revenue flows. When those revenue flows didn't come in, they needed to look at reducing expenditure, which they have done, but they haven't done enough in terms of lifting taxation and improving the outlook for economic growth in the economy. So they're the couple of areas where the government certainly has fallen down.
This situation as it is now, there could well be fairly significant inflation. What can the government do, or what should the government do to try and reverse this?
Well, part of it is just being more transparent as to exactly what's going on. We know that at the end of June is the latest numbers we've got, that at that stage the central bank had essentially purchased half of the entire year's deficit. We don't know what's happened since then. So some of it's about transparency. That'd be a very easy first step. Beyond that, they need to hold on to some of the taxation measures they actually did introduce in the budget. But they are now talking about meeting again in January and possibly unwinding some of those tax increases in areas such as on the logging industry and the forestry sector in Papua New Guinea. So in these sort of circumstances where there isn't enough transparency about what is happening with these government's borrowings, it's a circumstance where international lenders would be very, very cautious if they don't understand their risks, if there isn't transparency, and if there's a risk of high inflation forcing down the exchange rate, because this is another sort of consequence, this will make it much, much harder for them to ever finance a sovereign bond.
The Cook Islands government hopes to increase the amount of renewable energy powering Rarotonga from 15% to 50% very soon. The Green Climate Fund, a United Nations fund to help developing countries adapt climate change, has granted the Cook Islands $12 million U.S. dollars to expand the main island's energy grid. The announcement is the first in a series of projects which will be led by the Asian Development Bank to expand renewable energy around the Pacific. The Chief of Staff of the Prime Minister's Office, Elizabeth Reith-Kotola, told Jamie Tahanaha the grid can't handle the current uptake of renewable energy, and the expansion will help solve that.
It was a big announcement and one that we're very happy to have secured those funds for $12 million US, which will contribute towards battery storage of renewable energies for the utility in Rarotonga.
Battery storage for the utility, could you elaborate on that a bit more?
We've had a very positive uptake in renewable energy from the private sector and from homes around the island of Rarotonga, and it's gotten to a point where we've actually taken on so much renewable energy into our grid that we have had to stop taking on additional renewables onto the grid because it might compromise the integrity of the grid. So by getting these funds to be able to store this energy, we can then continue to take on renewable energy onto our grid. So at the moment...
Okay, so this increases the capacity of the grid on Rarotonga.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It increases the ability for the utility to take on additional renewable energy connections onto its main grid.
How much extra renewable energy do you hope to take?
We hope to take as much as we can, to be honest, but we estimate from this project, currently we are taking on 15% of our energy is coming from renewable sources now onto the grid, so we hope to increase that to about 50% with this project.
Okay, so 50% of Rarotonga from renewable energy after this project. And most of the outer islands are solar renewable now too, aren't they? So that means a good portion of Cook Islands is now renewable energy.
Yes. Yes, we have completed the transformation of the northern Cook Islands to renewable energy sources, and we're currently going through the procurement process for the conversion of four of the southern group islands to renewable. We anticipate that we should complete the conversion of these four islands by the end of next year.
And what about the project on Rarotonga? When does that start and finish?
With the approval, the accredited entity for us in this project has been the Asian Development Bank, and the Asian Development Bank will then work together with ourselves and the Green Climate Fund Secretariat to go through the process of securing the funds. We hope that this will be sooner rather than later.
The way aid is being delivered in developing countries is changing, with donor nations taking more a back seat to large multinational companies. Earlier this year, the United Nations Development Programme praised the role of foreign businesses in the response to the Papua New Guinea severe drought. Meanwhile, the aid programs of New Zealand and Australia have moved away from their previous emphasis on poverty alleviation. One local NGO had relied on aid from Australia and New Zealand is Appropriate Technology, which is involved in a myriad of areas, including improving water and sanitation services for remote communities. Don Wiseman asked AT Steve Lighton if the loss of this government aid had hurt them.
I suppose in many ways we've been rather fortunate. I can't say we saw this coming, but we've been preparing ourselves for this type of event. So we've been working very closely with some of the mining and resource companies who want us to do the same sort of work, really. So we've been changing our approach. So we're quite busy in New Ireland at the moment. We've been doing work for people like Ramu Sugar. So mining companies that have a social obligation find it very difficult to actually get people to do this sort of work, particularly people within country. So we've changed our approach a little bit, which has put us in a slightly better position, but certainly not a perfect position, that's for sure.
This movement by the big multinationals, is this a new development generally in PNG?
No, I don't think so. I think there's always been opportunities there, but a lot of NGOs are very reluctant to work with, say, resource companies, so a mining company, for example. You know, they see that as somehow like working with the devil, I suppose. But it's not like that. These resource companies have a social obligation. They want to fulfill it where they can. So it's just a different approach, really. And what it's meant for us is that we've got quite a lot of work now in this area, and we're being approached by mining companies quite recently. In fact, 3 or 4 days ago, I had an approach from Hidden Valley. They want to do some water and sanitation work, and they are part of another company that they got to hear about us. So we're, I suppose, in a lot better position than many of the other NGOs in PNG. I think certainly it's going to be a large percentage of what money is available for development in PNG.
Do you think this is the way aid will go increasingly and away from money coming in from donor governments?
You know, a lot of the international donors are either pulling out or they're concentrating on their own organisations rather than supporting smaller local organisations. That's becoming clear. And there is this quite large pool of money in the resource sector that I don't think we've really tapped into before. So as long as, you know, we're not going out there waving the flag of the company, we're just going out there and doing these community development projects. I think it means better projects for the resource owners, the landowners.
So it's somewhat ironic in a lot of ways, isn't it? We've got the governments concentrating on fairly showy economic development type things, but we've got the companies prepared to put money into important social activities.
And I think that's always been there in many ways. Obviously, landowners and resource owners want some benefits from these mining companies or the large agricultural companies. They want some benefits. In the past, they will be jumping up and down because they haven't got those benefits. And the resource companies, I think, have honestly found it quite difficult to provide appropriate benefits. It's okay just going in there and building a nice, fancy, glossy building, but that's generally not what people want. So using local resources like ourselves and other NGOs is a compromise that makes sense.
Nayu Honey has won 2 golds and an international best in a show at the British Honey Awards. General Manager Richard Duncan and Bee Whispery Andy Corey say the wins come as a sweet surprise. Mr. Duncan sent 4 jars of Nayu Honey to the competition in 2 categories at this year's UK National Honey Show, months ahead of time, and actually had forgotten about it. Jamie Tahanaha spoke to them both.
Yeah, so it was a surprise. So we went up there a year ago and didn't do so well. We fell short on the presentation factor.
We think our honey had jet lag.
So we knew we were in trouble when we arrived there and everyone was getting their honey out with white gloves on and ours was bouncing around in the back of the taxi. But we had very good feedback, you know, so the judges tasted it. Look, this is fantastic. I'm just sorry, you know, it's the presentation, you know, 0. We came back a bit sort of despondent. But what we had done is we'd made some connections up there. And so for this year, I contacted them and said, look, can you put it in on our behalf? We sent the honey up a couple of months in advance and it sat in the hot water cupboard and all the bubbles came to the surface. And they even put Glad wrap over the top and peel it back to get the skin off the top. And then they recanter it in glass and put it in. I'd forgotten about it. We've been so busy down this end. And so it was a very nice surprise to get that email saying congratulations. Not only have you won both categories, you entered first place and the middle of the Ukraine. We always knew it was a great honey. Had always had fantastic feedback, even though informal, but professional feedback. So this is just proof now, I think, it was the best honey.
Richard, remind me again of what those 2 categories were and what the medal of the Ukraine means.
It's a British honey show, but they have an open section that allows international entries. And there's 2 categories in that. One was, I think, clear honey, and the other was like a gift set. I'm not quite sure now on the exact categories. And the medal of the Ukraine was gifted by the Ukrainian Beekeepers Association for the Outstanding International Honey. And I think Ukraine is, I believe, the heart of beekeeping in Europe.
one from this part of the world wouldn't necessarily think of the Ukraine as being the home of honey. Yeah. Hey, just going between these two different years of competition, how did the honey itself differ other than in appearance and the bubbles and so on?
Well, it's exactly the same. It was just preparation, really. The competition is so rigorous. There's 1,200 contestants going through, and if they just see air bubbles when they put it up against the light, they just don't open it.
Andy, isn't it fantastic that Richard made those contacts for your next year?
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. We've got to do a talk on Pacific Island beekeeping, and we've got to do, Richie's doing one on our bee sanctuary we're setting up in Niue. But I've been up there 16 years, 18 years now, working away on it. And when I started off there, when it was abandoned, we bought it off the government. We bought the whole honey industry off the government. So if you see a bee on Niue, it's ours, basically. And I always knew they were special. I knew the bees were special. I had no idea that the bees around the world would be tanking.
And is it the same gene pool, post-cyclone and so on, or have you introduced new bees?
No, we don't have to. We've got very good bees, and that's my sort of specialty. I'm a specialist queen rearer. Last year we narrowed it down to our 50 best hives, and then we narrowed it down to our best 8, and we had a very good run. In 1 week we raised 1,386 cells. And we requeened the whole outfit, which has changed the genetic stock. And now we've more or less narrowed it down to 2 super hives that are really cranking. Every time we see them, every month we go back to them, we've done a box of honey, which is 25 kgs.
Okay, so in terms of financial benefit for Niue Honey, I'm picking that you've got 2 really good things going for you internationally. This recent award and having this bee sanctuary is obviously going to be an attractive proposition as well. How do you expect the two to impact on demand and bottom line for Niue Honey?
We have taken the approach that we've got 30 landowner shareholders that our beehives are on their sites. And now that the honey price internationally is moving, and once we start packing the honey under the 2 gold medal brand, our major focus is on increased dividends to the landowners. We can't operate there without landowners. We pay them so much a site, and then we pay them a royalty a box. And this year we've doubled the royalty, and I hope that when we get our honey on the market, we can increase the royalty more, and more landowners come on board. If we haven't got landowners, we haven't got a honey business.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Those who are listening to the program on Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea on 101.9 FM will be able to catch a second transmission of our daily program, repeat it an hour after it first goes out. The details will be at our website, pcjmedia.com, within the next few days. From everyone at the PCJ Radio International Newsroom, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.